Back in 1979, news reports appeared in the United States about a pair of identical twins. These 39-year-old men, one was named Jim Lewis and the other was named Jim Springer, had been separated a few weeks after they were born and adopted by two different families living in different towns in the state of Ohio. Now, seeking to learn about his birth family, one of them discovered to his astonishment when he was 39 that he had a twin brother out there somewhere, and he proceeded to track this identical twin brother down. Although they had been raised apart, they discovered that they had much in common. It turned out that both had dogs as youngsters, and each had named his dog Troy. Both had divorced their first wife, a woman named Linda. Then they both married women named Betty. They were raised apart. They didn't know each other. Both had a son. One of them named his son James Allen, A-L-L-E-N, and the other named his son James Allen, A-L-A-N. A reporter visited both men at home in their separate towns and took pictures of each man smoking a Salem cigarette in his basement woodworking shop. The reporter noted that each man had constructed a white lawn seat around the trunk of a tree in his backyard. The wives of both twins got together and talked, and they discovered that each husband had the endearing habit of leaving little love notes around the house. Both men drove Chevrolets. They were both chain smokers. They both chewed their fingernails. They both drank Miller Lite beer. They both had worked as deputy sheriffs in their respective communities. They both enjoyed stock car racing, and they both disliked baseball. As they became better acquainted, the two families learned that well before their meeting, both had taken spring holidays on the Gulf Coast of the state of Florida, driving down in their Chevrolets from Ohio to the same quarter-mile stretch of beach. Now, people found all this so remarkable that the twins were invited to appear on national television programs, and researchers began to look more closely at how our genes might predetermine who we are. And as a minister, I wondered if our genes determined whether or not we are theists or agnostics or atheists. This research, which started in the 1980s, is called the Minnesota Study for Identical Twins Reared Apart, or simply the Minnesota Twins Project. The researchers found twins who were reared apart but were both devoted to dogs. They found a pair of identical twins raised by different parents who had become professional firefighters. They found identical twins raised apart who both became amateur gunsmiths. The research suggests that many things we think we choose to do because of our free will or because of the influence of a teacher or the influence of a friend or a parent, we may actually be doing because of our genetic makeup. Now, the relationship is not 100%, but instead a matter of increased probability. For example, based on the sample of about 200 identical twins raised apart, if one of you has an identical twin somewhere in the world, and you like to go hunting and fishing, you have a 72% chance that your identical twin also likes to go hunting and fishing. If you have an identical twin somewhere in the world and you are a performing artist, such as an actor or a musician, you have a 74% chance that your identical twin also is a performing artist. Well, evidence like this showed the importance of genes in determining who we are. In 1987, geneticists such as James Watson, the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, asked President Reagan and Congress to fund a project to map the entire human genome. This was biology's equivalent of putting a human on the moon. With this map, researchers could compare the genes with genes of people, say, with a history of cancer in their families to people without that history of cancer and discover identify the genetic makeup of the people who have a history of cancer and try to eliminate certain illnesses. The funding was approved in 1987, and James Watson, the discoverer of the structure of DNA, was appointed head of the genome program, which was located at the National Institute of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, about a mile away from where I served as a minister for 18 years. Now, Watson was raised Catholic. He described himself as an escapee from the Catholic religion. He said, "The luckiest thing that ever happened to me was that my father didn't believe in God." In 1992, James Watson suddenly left the project, was forced to resign by the director of the National Institute of Health. They had a dispute. They had private companies who were out there deciphering part of the human genome. And Watson felt that all this information should be collected in one place at the National Institute of Health, and that it should be free for access to anyone, that anyone should have access to it, open information. Whereas the private companies who had done the research, were trying to patent the human genes that they had discovered so that people would have to pay money to get access to their research. Watson wanted it open. The companies didn't. Watson was forced to resign. Eventually, the Supreme Court ruled that all of the human genome is publicly available information and cannot be patented. But this left the project without a director. So a search committee was formed, and the director of the National Institute of Health eventually asked a geneticist named Francis Collins to assume the role of project head at the National Human Genome Research Institute in Bethesda. Later, Francis Collins wrote about the experience of being asked to take charge. He said, "No one was more surprised than I to find the selection process converging on me in 1993. Being quite happy at the time, leading a genome center at the University of Michigan, and never having imagined myself as a federal employee, I initially indicated no interest. But the decision haunted me. There was only one human genome project. This was going to be done only once in human history. If it succeeded, the consequences for medicine would be unprecedented. As a believer in God, was this one of those moments when I was somehow being called to take on a larger role in a project that would have profound consequences for our understanding of ourselves? Here was a chance to read the language of God, to determine the intimate details of how humans had come to be. Could I walk away? I always have been suspicious of those who claim to perceive God's will in moments such as this. But the awesome significance of this adventure and the potential consequences for humankind's relationship with the Creator could hardly be ignored. He goes on, visiting my daughter in North Carolina in November of 1992, I spent a long afternoon praying in a little chapel, seeking guidance about this decision. I did not hear God speak. In fact, I've never had that experience. But during those hours, ending in an evensong service that I had not expected, a prayer, a peace settled over me. And a few days later, I accepted the offer. So with the leadership of Francis Collins, the human genome mapping moved steadily ahead, and the basic research was finished by the year 2000. A friend of mine, a member of the Unitarian Church who was working on this, said, you know, I used to think that genes determine 50% of who we are and that the environment determined the other 50%. Now I'm convinced that genes are 95% of who we are and how we behave and how we live, and I'm really not sure about that other 5%. But frankly, the work of interpreting the genome data is still in its initial stages. It's starting to produce a few results. For example, researchers at the National Cancer Institute discovered a genetic test that can identify breast cancer patients who are unlikely to suffer recurrences in breast cancer. And this test offers a solution to a difficult problem in breast cancer treatment, deciding which persons can safely skip the expensive, debilitating follow-up treatments. It is one of the first real benefits of the efforts to map the human genome to fight cancer. Now, for many years, until his retirement 3 years ago, the director of the gene structure section at the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda was a doctor named Dean Hammer. In his spare time, in 2004, Dr. Hammer published a book called The God Gene, How Faith is Hardwired into Our Genes. The title, no doubt picked by the publisher and the publisher's marketing department, the title is somewhat misleading if you read the book. In the book, Hammer focuses on words like self-transcendence, not words like God or faith. The definition of self-transcendence Hammer uses comes from a questionnaire developed by a psychiatrist at Washington University Medical School in St. Louis. The questionnaire has 225 true or false questions. I'll just read them all to you. Now here are a few examples. True or false? I often feel so connected to people around me that it is like there is no separation between us. True or false? True or false, I often do things to help protect animals and plants from extinction. True or false? I am fascinated by the many things in life that cannot be scientifically explained. True or false? Often I have unexpected flashes of insight or understanding while resting. True or false? Sometimes I have felt like I was part of something with no limits or boundaries in time and space. Now, Dr. Hammer judged that people who answered true on many of these questions could be classified as more self-transcendent, more spiritual. He gave these questions to 1,000 college students, paying them $40 to take the questionnaire and donate DNA. The students each donated a sample of their DNA for the study. So then he looked for relationships between the answers that the students gave on the questionnaire and their genetic makeup. He looked at genes he suspected that might play a role in feelings of self-transcendence in human beings. In the first 8 genes he studied, he found no association with self-transcendence. Then a colleague suggested Hammer look at a gene called VMAT2. This gene, I'm going to need help with pronunciation here. This gene plays a key role in regulating the levels of the brain chemicals serotonin, dopamine, and NORE. Okay, one person raised their hand who knows it. Norepinephrine. Yes. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Two different versions of this gene exist. They differ only in a single position. People with one version of the gene got higher spirituality or self-transcendent scores on the questionnaire. So on page 77 of his book, Dr. Hammer says, our analysis of the VMAT2 polymorphist, show something like that, shows that it raises self-transcendent scores only by a single point, or 7% of the mean, less than 1% of total variance. That means that most of the inherited effects on self-transcendent cannot be explained by VMAT2. Hammer believes there might be another 50 genes of more or similar strength. He writes, the specific gene I have identified is by no means the entire story behind spirituality. He speculates that these genes may have evolved in us to give us a feeling of optimism about life. The self-transcendent genes have developed in humans through natural selection because these genes give us an innate sense of optimism, the will to keep on reproducing, even after we had the first child and realized how hard it was. Keep on reproducing, even if we realize that death is inevitable, the optimistic genes. The reaction to Hammer's book has been mixed. The reviewer in Scientific America said, the field of behavioral genetics is littered with failed links between particular genes and personality traits. These alleged associations at first seem very strong, but as other researchers try to replicate them, they fade away into statistical noise. Reviews from some religious leaders were also negative. One theologian in England said, the idea of a God gene goes against all my personal theological convictions. You can't cut faith down to the lowest common denominator of genetic survival. It shows the poverty of reductionist thinking. On the other hand, the American news magazine Time gave it a cover story, free publicity that other writers would envy, a big picture with the words God gene on the cover. And then a full-page article in the religion section of the Washington Post was published. And then other newspapers picked up the same story. Well, like the editors of Time and the Washington Post, I find this topic interesting. Dean Hammer may have only found a gene that has a small influence on our spirituality, but I don't want to be too negative. Hammer is suggesting that just as some of us are born with blue eyes and some of us are born with brown eyes, some of us are born more likely to feel spirituality or optimism or self-transcendence, and some of us are born less likely to have these feelings. His work is a beginning step in understanding the genes that may influence our interest in religion. And I am grateful for his willingness to explore this aspect of human nature. But meanwhile, what happened to Francis Collins, the geneticist who completed the Human Genome Code in 2000? In the summer of 2009, Francis Collins was nominated by the new president, President Obama, to become the director of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, a geneticist in charge of all our scientific research in the area of medicine and health. NIH is the primary government agency responsible for biomedical and healthcare research with a budget of $31 billion. Sam Harris, a neuroscientist, not a geneticist, a neuroscientist, and an author of books such as The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation, Sam was not pleased. In July 2009, the New York Times published an essay by Sam Harris in which he said that Collins' religious views made him unqualified to be director of the NIH. Harris said, "Most scientists who study the human mind are convinced that minds are the products of brains, and brains are the products of evolution. Collins takes a different approach. He insists that at some moment in the development of our species, God inserted crucial components, including an immortal soul, free will, the moral law, and spiritual hunger." Harris goes on, "Collins has written," and then he quotes Collins, "science offers no answers to the most pressing questions of human existence, and that the claims of atheistic materialism must be steadfastly resisted." And Harris says, "Must we really entrust the future of biomedical research in the United States to a man who sincerely believes that scientific understanding of human nature is impossible?" Well, in spite of Sam Harris's letter to the New York Times, Congress approved Francis Collins' appointment, and he is currently the director of the National Institute of Health. So what do geneticists say about God? As you can see, it depends on who you ask. When asked if he believes in God, James Watson said, "Oh no, absolutely not." And then he goes on, Watson says, "I know one geneticist who is religious, and I don't understand him at all. We have different brains." I assume that Dr. Watson was speaking of Dr. Francis Collins. Collins says, "I have found there is a wonderful harmony in the complementary truths of science and religion. God can be found in the cathedral or in the laboratory. By investigating God's majesty and awesome creation, science can actually be a means of worship." Well, Dean Hammer argues that our spiritual beliefs are due to our genes and they offer an evolutionary advantage by helping us feel optimistic and keeping us to reproducing. Sam Harris, the neurologist, says, "Faith is the license religious people give one another to keep believing when reason fails." But Harris also says, Harris is not one-dimensional. He's a complicated thinker. He also says, "This universe is shot through with mystery. The very fact of its being and of our own is a mystery and the only miracle worthy of the name." As for myself, there are moments when I feel a sense of optimism, exchanging a smile with you at a worship service on Sunday morning. There are moments when I feel a sense of transcendence walking on a beach or through a forest. There are moments when I feel a sense of spirituality listening to the sounds of gorgeous, wonderful music. Someday a geneticist may be able to explain that I feel this way because of my genetic code. However, this does not make the experience an illusion. In the same way, a geneticist may some way identify the genes that cause me to have ears, but that does not mean that the sounds I hear are an illusion. As Sam Harris says, the universe is shot through with mystery. The very fact of its being and of our own is a mystery and the only miracle worthy of the name. And I and every one of you are a small part of that mystery.